This is Nick DeOlius. You're listening to the Far Middle Podcast, episode 40, one of those milestone episode numbers. Hard to believe that we've hit 40 in a very short period of time, at least it seems. And who are we going to dedicate this week's episode to? Well, if you're looking at number 40, I think there's only one answer in the end. That's got to be the great Gale Sayers. The Kansas Comet, as he's widely known, in college, an All-American, came into the NFL in the 60s and was a Rookie of the Year standout. He set a season touchdown record in the NFL as a rookie, at 22, I believe. Played seven seasons officially, but really only five because of injury. So he had a very short career, as great as he was. But one of the sort of aspects, I think, of his greatness is what he did in a very short period of time. Not exactly an accumulator when it came to statistics like you see today or you've seen in the past in sports. He was more of a light that flared very brightly for a shorter period of time. And the reason his career was shortened was, of course, because of his knees. In fact, he had severe knee injuries in both knees over the course of his professional career. Had that first one, and then he basically came roaring back after he recovered from the first knee injury. I think he was a comeback player of the year after that, but then he suffered a second one, which basically in the end cut his career short. Now, Gale Sayers, when I think of him, I think of what he's doing on the field too, but I'm also thinking, of course, of what he did off the field. He's one of the better known athletes because of what he contributed off the field. And everybody thinks of Gale Sayers off the field, they think of Brian Song, the movie, which I was first introduced to, like probably a lot of people my age, in school. It was one of those movies that you would see in certain classes in school. When you were growing up, and that was sort of my introduction and the Brian Piccolo story and Billy Dee Williams doing a great job playing Gale Sayers in the movie. But most people don't realize that Brian Song, the movie, really came from a book that Gale Sayers co-authored, and the book was titled I Am Third. And this was sort of Gale Sayers' approach or philosophy to life. When he says I am third, he's basically saying God and his religion came first, and then comes family and friends second. And then he personally came third. He put himself third out of that list. Just, again, an interesting view on life or take on life that he was able to sort of capture on the pages of a book, which ultimately became a movie, Brian Song, which is an awesome movie. If you never had a chance to see it, I'd recommend that you give it a look. Youngest player ever, still I think the youngest player to be elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame because of that shortened career. And Mike Ditka, a Pittsburgh guy, a Western Pennsylvania guy who played with Sayers. He, you know, Hall of Famer himself, he saw great players come and go at all positions. Mike Ditka said it best. He said that Gale Sayers was the greatest player he ever saw. Greatest ever, period, not just running back. We lost him a couple years ago, partly because of dementia, which is partly caused by, you know, his playing career and the hits that he was taking. So rest in peace, Gale Sayers. And his most famous saying, at least from my perspective, was when he would say, just give me 18 inches of daylight, that's all I need. So episode 40, dedicated to the great Gale Sayers. And I think Sayers' quote about give me 18 inches of daylight, that's all I need, I think that'll kick off episode 40 here and bring us to our next point that we can connect to, which is it used to be not long ago when it came to the American worker, the working woman, the working man, their approach to making it in life would be, just give me a job, that's all I need. If you give me that opportunity to go work and achieve, I will take it from there. And that was sort of ingrained and it was what created and drove, catalyzed the great American work ethic. You saw that everywhere. You didn't just see that with the individual worker, right? You saw that in pop culture. If you go to the area of rock music and you look at different songs and lyrics through the years, it all celebrated that one way or another. I'm a fan of Rush, the Canadian group Rush, and one of their earliest songs, maybe their first really sort of well-known song, was Working Man, and it's the type of song with the type of lyrics, and there's dozens of examples beyond Rush that just celebrated that sort of grit and getting at it to go achieve and accomplish through good old-fashioned hard work and sweat out there in sort of the job market. Today, it's a different story, you know, completely different vibe today. What you see today is almost a turning away from the American work ethic. And we have a problem, frankly, and the data, I think, are proving it and definitely blaring that we have a significant problem. You hear a lot about the Great Resignation, right? And how that's being somewhat, to a large extent, celebrated by academics and by government and by the media. But I think, you know, aside the issues of where the great resignation may equate from time to time to individuals being able to further improve themselves or increase their station in life, which is great, I think the great resignation really is about something else altogether, which is a turning away from the American work ethic and embracing something very different. And I came across a piece, a paper done by the American Enterprise Institute recently, and some of the data, some of the findings in this study were frankly shocking. I just wanted to share them with you on this podcast. The AEI study looked at sort of labor and workforce from a number of different sort of data points and time periods, but as I said, very sort of stunning takeaways. And the first one was the overall labor force participation rate. It peaked in what year? It peaked in the year 2000. And that's been, you know, a while ago, 20 plus years ago. So 2000 was sort of our high watermark when it comes to labor force participation. And it was 67%. It wasn't like it was, you know, incredibly high, but that was 20 plus years ago. And what is really shocking is that if you look at that labor force participation rate today, it is actually lower today in the United States than it was during the Great Depression. That completely blew me away, that our labor force participation rate today is below what it was during the Great Depression. I think that sort of paints a perspective that is pretty stunning. And another interesting data point, again, this goes back to 2000, sort of a 2000 comparison as well. If you looked at the employment to population ratio, so if you took the employment to population ratio in 2000, and then you said we were going to maintain that same ratio, that same level today, how many more workers would you need in the job market? There would be 13 million more workers, 13 million, if we just would have preserved that employment to population ratio from the year 2000 if we had it applied in 2022. Now, the second sort of takeaway that was shocking to me was I've been a critic, as many of you know, that have been constant listeners of the European Union, of the EU. I often sort of poke fun at Europe, and I'll make the comment from time to time that if we don't get our act together in the United States, then we're going to end up looking more and more like Europe. Our future is going to be more and more about Europe. I think I owe apology to my European friends, because when it comes to labor and workforce, we're actually now trailing the EU. And you can look at something like prime age work rate, where historically in America, we were easily above Europe's prime age work rate, which is a good proxy, right? When you look at strong prime age work rates, that means you usually have good business health, good corporate earnings, which helps capital markets. You've got good levels of household income, right? Government revenue is good, so tax base and deficits and things like that are good. Now, when you've got poor prime age work rates, sort of the inverse, the corollaries occur, which are all the negatives. But right now, Europe, where we were significantly above Europe not long ago, right now, Europe is a couple of points higher than what we're experiencing in America when it comes to prime age work rate, which is, again, just unbelievable to me. And once again, when you see that, there will be follow-on consequences and effects from it. So you're going to see household income taking a hit. You're going to see business and corporate earnings taking a hit, which then will follow on and bleed into capital markets. And you're going to see government revenue take a hit. Maybe, dare I say, one of the root causes of why we're now looking at over $30 trillion in government debt in the United States. And when you're trying to trace through these epic shifts that are occurring when it comes to workforce participation and what's going on with the labor markets and the work ethic and the great resignation, to muddy the waters even further, right, you had COVID and pandemic and the shutdowns that went with it on top of it, which really clouded things to try to get these clear trend lines. But yet, even despite all the noise of shutdowns and how that sort of screws up the data, you still see some pretty compelling trends, because before COVID, there were more unfilled jobs in the United States than there were people out of work. So we sort of had this anomaly pre-shutdown, and now post-shutdown, it's become even more marked, where you've got two open jobs roughly for every unemployed woman and man that's out there in the United States. Just unprecedented times. We had it before shutdowns and pandemic, and now we've got it even to a greater extent post-shutdowns, now that we're back up and running. Now, what are people doing instead of working? Well, I went back and tracked some data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They do what they call the American Time Use Survey. And what's interesting is, I don't know if you knew this or not, but the average man in America is watching through, I guess, digital media and streaming 2,000 hours of whatever, programming content a year. 2,000 hours a year. That's almost a profession or a job in and of itself. And that's the average. Who knows what people on the higher end of that range are clocking in at. And again, the overall, I think, takeaway from this, just culturally, is that we've shifted where it used to be that you were sort of encouraged and you were looked up to if you went out and you did, you were doing. Right now, it's don't go out and be a doer. Instead, you know, stay at home and catch whatever, you know, binge session you need to catch on with your favorite series or show on whatever streaming service you subscribe to. Cumulatively, if you start seeing that ingrained culturally across all of our working women and men that are out there, that is not going to be a good thing when it comes to American competitiveness and just the overall sort of American psyche. So if government policy and culturally we're starting to denigrate work and demote it, and it's keeping people more and more at home, not going out and doing, well, then what are they doing at home? Right? We mentioned the digital streaming and thousands of hours of that each year on average. Maybe they're gaming, maybe they're day trading in their spare bedroom or in their basement. Who knows? Maybe, and this is going to bring us to our next point on this episode of The Far Middle, maybe they're trying to read James Joyce's Ulysses, that classic book. I gave it a go over the past year, and you know, I've heard so much about Ulysses, and I'm a fan of James Joyce, but I heard this is, you know, one of the top books of all time. It takes place in a day, right, on the streets of Dublin. So I said, how challenging can this be? Well, I tried giving it a read, and I gave up. I capitulated, because this book is very frustrating. I don't know if any of you have tried to give Ulysses a read, and whether you were successful in completing it or not. But the thing that really just sort of brought me to a grinding halt is that most books and most authors, when they're writing books, they can be very different stylistically, very different types of ways of writing or methods of writing, but they're somewhat consistent. When you start reading a book, you can get used to that style and you pick it up and then you get through and navigate through the actual experience, the book. But with Ulysses, it's almost as if it's written by, you know, a half a dozen different authors. There's all kinds of different styles, and they just change abruptly. He just changes up styles almost on a dime, and you're just getting used to the one style that he's employing in that book, and then before you know it, he changes it on you yet again, and it just threw me off time and time again. So I'm a fan of Dublin. In Ireland. I'm a fan of James Joyce. I spent time at the Newman House. For those of you who are familiar with Dublin, that's right off of St. Stephen's Green, very historic building. It is now part of the UCD campus, but it's also a building and a site where James Joyce himself was once a student. So, you know, I've got a lot of sort of indirect ties to James Joyce, and I should be a huge advocate of Ulysses, but I just can't be a fan of what I can't comprehend. And I just can't understand and break through Ulysses. I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to give up entirely. I'm sure I'll revisit it down the road. But, you know, I did some research on sort of people and are they having trouble getting through Ulysses. I'm not alone, by the way. There's many in my camp. But I came across a quote from James Joyce when they asked him about, you know, the way he constructed Ulysses. And here's his quote I want to share with you. He said, quote, "I've put in so many enigmas and puzzles that it will keep the professors busy for centuries arguing over what I meant, and that's the only way of ensuring one's immortality," end quote. I think James Joyce was messing with us. By the way, he wrote Ulysses. I learned this a couple years ago. He didn't write Ulysses in Ireland. He wrote it and wrote most of it in Zurich, Switzerland, when he was spending time there. And the people that he befriended and that he was observing in Zurich, a lot of those individuals served as a basis for certain characters in the book itself. Now, while I was getting my intellectual hat handed to me, trying to deconstruct and understand, comprehend Ulysses, I came across a letter that Mr. Churchill, Winston Churchill, a number of years before Joyce published Ulysses, had written to another noted author, H.G. Wells. So this letter was from the early 1900s. Churchill was a young man, and he writes the note to H.G. Wells. And I thought it was a really timely insight from 120 plus years ago, from a great individual, Winston Churchill, that had a lot to say about where we're at today in 2022. So Churchill wrote to H.G. Wells, he said, "Nothing would be more fatal than for the government estates to get into the hands of the experts. Expert knowledge is limited knowledge, and the unlimited ignorance of the plain man who knows only what hurts is a safer guide than any vigorous direction of a specialized character. Why should you assume that all except doctors, engineers, etc. are drones or worse? If the ruler is to be an expert in anything, he should be an expert in everything, and that is plainly impossible." So how insightful was Churchill back in 1901, I think, writing to H.G. Wells when it comes to the dangers and the trappings of the expert class across society? Pretty telling stuff from 120 plus years ago. And now I sort of run the risk, I guess, of getting into the Twilight Zone and the absurd, because, you know, I started with James Joyce and Ulysses, and talked a little bit about Winston Churchill, who was a noted author, a very prolific publisher in his own right, writing letters to H.G. Wells. And I'm going to bring this issue of the expert class and Churchill's identification of the dangers of reliance on the expert class into modern day in a book that I've got coming out in a couple of weeks, Precipice. So again, you know, sort of comparing this hack of an author to those greats is absurd and a bit surreal via Twilight Zone. But nevertheless, the themes that are raised in Precipice really do speak to what Churchill was talking about 120 plus years ago with respect to the dangers of the expert class. And you can see this in academia and education. You see this with respect to media, especially mainstream media. You see this with the bureaucratic state, as I reference it, the deep state, not deep as in hidden or secret, but deep as in entrenched tentacles, you know, burrowing deeply across all sort of segments of society. You see it across all these different avenues where the expert class and the elite class is basically laying waste to things like the middle class and the American work ethic and the doers in society. And that's obviously not a good thing. And one of the underlying sort of symptoms that you see with respect to all these different examples that are out there, and I think Precipice in the book, it brings that out, is how you initially see the taking, the hijacking, the commandeering of science, and then sort of, you know, grotesquely adjusting, disconfiguring it into something that is much more akin to political science. And science being, you know, distorted into political science, it sort of brings us to our next dot on episode 40 of the Far Middle, which is combining. Let's have a combined Fauci focus and mask mania moment. The sort of cumulative, I'll call it, impact momentum of the expert elite class during COVID, during pandemic, was to, in many ways, suppress any sort of views, scientific views, that were against what the elite or expert class, or at least the noisiest segment of it, desired to be truth. And one of the biggest examples of this that I brought up on a prior episode of The Far Middle was the Great Barrington Declaration. The Great Barrington Declaration had 50,000 experts, doctors, scientists, etc., that basically took the view that mass shutdowns were much more harmful than beneficial when it came to the pros and the cons and the risks and the rewards because of all the collateral damage that shutdowns would precipitate. And that view and that declaration was widely and consciously suppressed all across Western society. The media suppressed it, elite academia suppressed it, the elite medical community suppressed it, government suppressed it. And I'm not a doctor, and I don't know all the particulars of how COVID spreads and, you know, efficacy of different treatments and what masks do or what they don't do. But I do know that when you've got a declaration signed by 50,000 medical and scientific experts in the field saying that all in all, you know, shutdowns across the board, draconian shutdowns, do much more damage than good when you're weighing the risks and the rewards, that's something that should see a much broader light of day than it actually did. And the reason that it didn't see the light of day and get as widely disseminated was because, again, this elite expert class that was in power decided that they wanted to take a different approach. And again, you see this the scientific debate, scientific dissent being sort of commandeered by this ill-advised concept of scientific consensus, when the scientific consensus is the consensus of the few, sort of coming at the expense of the many. You know, the most elite sectors of culture, of society, were the ones that were the most guilty of taking science and morphing it into political science to sort of impose their will upon all of us. One of the best examples of this was professional sports. Specifically, I like to talk about the NFL. You know, now that the NFL season has successfully wrapped up with the Super Bowl a week ago. And what I found really interesting, again, going back to data don't lie, was looking at how quickly, how suddenly the whole NFL situation shifted when it came to COVID and pandemic. Because again, the NFL was one of those entities at the vanguard of virtue signaling when it came to everything from mask mandates to shutdowns to everything else, following the science, right, quote unquote, when really was following the political science. But just listen to some of these data. So for mid-December, before the playoffs started, you had 476 players that were placed on the COVID-19 reserve list, right? So following the NFL protocols at the time, mid-December, I'm looking at the 13th of December to the 27th, just past Christmas, 476 NFL players were placed on the COVID-19 reserve list. And what was really interesting about that too was 80% of those players, of those 476, were vaccinated. So you had, you know, high level vaccination, but despite that, almost 500 players on COVID-19 list. What's interesting is if you compared that number from December of 2021 at the end of last year, and you look at the entirety of the 2020 season, so the year prior, and remember, in the 2020 season, there were no vaccines, so no players were vaccinated. There was only 428 players who were placed on the COVID-19 reserve list for the entire 2020 season. So 2020, you had no players vaccinated because there was no vaccine. 428 players in total across the entire season were on the COVID-19 list. You go to just a couple weeks in December of 2021, when vaccines are widely available and 80% of the players are vaccinated, you had 476 players during that short period of time that were on the COVID-19 list. So the data itself are just interesting to me when you start looking at vaccination rate and who tested positive and who's on the COVID-19 list and who isn't, sort of year on year. But then what to me is the most shocking is that was mid-December, late December of last year, right before playoffs. All of a sudden, the playoffs start in the NFL. And of course, right, the chance for viewership goes up, advertising dollars, it's big business, of course. This is the busy time of the year for the NFL, the make or break time of the year. When you got into the start of the playoffs, 12 teams in the playoffs, 7 of the 12 didn't have a single COVID-19 reserve list addition. And of the other 5 teams, there were a total across the 5 teams of 7 players that were on or added to the COVID-19 list going into playoffs. You add it all up across all the playoff teams, only one starter. It was a cornerback for the Patriots. Only one starter who was a cornerback missed the team's playoff games because they were on or he was on the COVID-19 reserve list. Now, what does this tell us? I'm not sure what it tells us. I mean, again, the data don't lie. And to see, you know, I guess two takeaways. One, when there were no vaccines a year earlier, you had actually less players on the COVID-19 list across the entire season than you had players on the COVID-19 list with vaccinations at 80%. And for a brief 2-week period, at the end of 21, that's pretty interesting and pretty surprising. But what's even more shocking to me is that a week or two later, playoffs start, 12 teams, you got basically, 7 of the 12, 0 players added to the COVID-19 list. And of the 5 that did have players added, 7 cumulatively across the 5 teams, 1 starter across the entire NFL playoff set was added to the COVID-19 list. It seems like, if you're looking at the data, that shockingly or somehow that the NFL playoffs were the cure for COVID. It's almost as if you're following the science. What we need, I guess, are more NFL playoffs. Or maybe perhaps we were looking at either political science or the business reality of where things were going, and the NFL made a determination that COVID-19 no longer was the serious threat that it had been warranting that it was for God knows how many seasons, I guess two seasons running. And those of you who've been listening to the Far Middle for a while know that I'm not a rejecter of COVID not being real, or I'm not a conspiracy theorist when it comes to the medical side of pandemic. But what I am saying is that when you look at entities like the NFL that are out there at the vanguard of our culture and our political and business establishments, many of them over the past couple of years have proven that when they say they're following the science, what they're really doing is they're conveniently aligning themselves to take advantage of how the political winds or the business winds are blowing at the time. And when it benefits their brand or it benefits their venture, they suddenly will adopt whatever quote-unquote science is most fortuitous at the time. And again, I think going into the start of this past year's NFL playoffs proves that via the data in sort of a pretty blatant manner. Now, a couple of you have been reaching out and asking over the past week for my thoughts on the Super Bowl with the Rams defeating the Bengals. And just a couple of thoughts I had there watching the game. I did watch it. This is sort of intriguing to me. I'm a sports guy at heart, but I've noticed this in the NFL now for a couple of years, probably the past 2 years. I saw this in the Super Bowl. I think it was during the first Bengals drive, their first touchdown. So the Bengals are driving down the field, and you're watching the game, and they're panning to the sidelines in between plays. And I see that you got, when the Rams defense is on the field, you got Aaron Donald, Pittsburgh native, Penn Hills native, so like Aaron Donald. But you got Aaron Donald, the best player on the defensive side of the football in the NFL. You know, all due respect to T.J. Watt of the Steelers, but you know, Aaron Donald is just an unbelievable player. And you got Von Miller, sort of the second best player on the Rams defense. So when your best player is the best in all of football, your second best is going to be pretty damn good himself. But the two of them were on the sidelines watching their defense, you know, go against the Bengals as the Bengals drove down the field and scored their touchdown. That's sort of the modern way, I guess, to manage defensive personnel. I see a lot of that in the NFL these days, but it just seems weird to me. It just seems really odd that you've got the Super Bowl, you've got your two best players on defense, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars that you've invested in them in salary. And I don't know if it's data analytics or what the science is behind it. I'm sure there's something that these teams are pointing towards that that warrants putting them on the sidelines for a few plays or a series. But it just doesn't seem to make sense to me. It just doesn't feel right. I see the same. I mentioned T.J. Watt a minute ago, but I see the same with the Steelers. I mean, they're infamous for pulling T.J. Watt from series, especially later in the game when the Steelers are playing, which, again, just seems odd when their defense is out on the field. Your best player isn't there with them. So, again, I'm sure there's sort of a method to the madness here, and there's some data behind it. It just seems very counterintuitive to me, and the Super Bowl really highlighted that. I can't say that I would envision, you know, back in the day during the Super Bowl that Mean Joe Green, when the Steelers were in their heyday, that he'd be taking a series off during that game. It's a Super Bowl, for goodness sake. Halftime show, interesting. I saw some real sort of contrasts. I saw that the NFL ran, I guess it was a commercial or an intro at the beginning of the game with Billie Jean King talking about Title IX women's athletics, which was interesting. And then at halftime, of course, you know, we had the multiple artists that were performing, very different look when it came to women and women's rights. And I'm not saying, you know, one's bad or one should be, you know, censored. I'm not saying any of that. But what I am saying is it was an interesting contrast to have an entity like the NFL on sort of the biggest stage, not just for them and for their season, but really the biggest stage commercially for anything and anyone in the world, with it being the Super Bowl. And you just had this very stark contrast of Billie Jean King at the start and, you know, the production, I'll call it, of the halftime show in the middle, and two completely different messages and images. I thought that was interesting. It definitely left a mark with me. And then the third thing, everybody asks about the commercials. I saw a commercial from a major car manufacturer, we'll leave it at that, that was referencing a famous movie with a Dr. Evil. And the whole premise of the commercial was, you know, let's save the world first through electric vehicles, and then we can be evil later. So sort of a, you know, comical spin on it. So let's get this straight. When you look at sort of electric vehicles and electric vehicle mandates, it's not, I don't think, like saving the world. I think it's more like taking middle-class taxpayers' dollars via massive subsidies, you know, funneling those dollars and the magnitude of billions of dollars to multi-billion-dollar corporations so that they can then funnel that money directly and indirectly to places like China and the Chinese Communist Party so that they can better oppress minorities through slave labor. And all of this in the end, because when you do the true carbon accounting of these carbon footprints, all of this is going to actually increase carbon dioxide emissions net compared to what we're doing now. So the commercial itself sort of struck me as a cute save the world first, right? Doing good by doing well and all that stuff. But the reality, when you look at, again, the science of it and the math of it, it is more like, let's make the world worse. Let's ruin the world. And then we'll get to what we're going to do to endear ourselves and make it a better place. All of it, of course, for the money. That takes us to the end of episode 40 of the Farm Middle Podcast. Like Gail Sayers said, just give me 18 inches of daylight. That's all I need. Just give me 30 minutes of your time each week. That's all I need. Talk to you soon.